Vic stayed in his apartment and read the afternoon papers until the 20th Century Limited was an hour out, hurtling along the magnificent Hudson. The news was good. The Germans were doomed. Vic skimmed through the pages rapidly and realized with a somewhat guilty feeling that he was no longer a student of the war, just a headline reader. Then he went into the club car for a drink. He spoke to some people he knew, a writer named Bennett and an agent whose name he'd forgotten, but avoided sitting with them. Most of the Hollywood group would stay in their compartments for this leg of the journey, not coming out until they boarded the Super Chief. The car was dominated by a drunken major who shook every newcomer's hand, saying, "I'm Oscar Skybush. What's your name?" He tried to buy everybody a drink, and he kept telling about how he had been overseas for 27 months, and now his wife didn't love him anymore. When an Army Air Force captain came in, the major said, "Hello, 9th Air Force!" And the captain was given the Oscar Skybush routine. Then the major announced, "This officer, ladies and gentlemen, has on his chest certain ribbons and decorations. Can any civilian in this car identify those ribbons properly for $10? Nobody said anything, and the major repeated the offer, adding, "We earn our ribbons the hard way, don't we, 9th Air Force? These goddamn civilians don't even know what they are." A woman cleared her throat and said in a tiny, appeasing voice, "The MST one's a DFC. And the major stumbled in her direction. He bowed extravagantly and said, "My compliments, madam. Now, for the benefit of those civilians present who are unaware of the meaning of the decorations which this officer wears so modestly, may I translate? Besides the distinguished flying cross with two oak leaves, the captain wears the air medal with three leaves, the purple heart, a European theater ribbon with 15 combat stars, and an Asiatic theater ribbon with 3 stars. He then sat down by the woman and was telling her about enduring 27 months overseas, but all the time thinking about coming home to his wife. And then he did come home, and look what happened. She was his second wife, he said, and he really loved her. The steward came in from the dining car and cleared the air by telling the major that his place was ready. He had to be helped through the lurching car. The man beside Vic said there was going to be a lot of that now, and it was a hell of a problem, really a hell of a problem. "I've got 2 boys over there," he said, "and you just don't know what to expect when they come back. One's in Germany, the other's in Italy." Someone turned on the radio. It was a spot announcement on Love That Soap. With great disgust, the man parroted to Vic, "Love That Soap. Beauty is as beauty does. Hollywood's favorite bar." "Oh, Jesus, I get tired of hearing that crap. They should force them to take those commercials off the air, or at least change them once in a while." "The only trouble," Vic explained, "was that they sold soap. Seems like the more you irritate people, the better they remember your brand. And that's half of selling." He told the man about the beauty sales curve. The man was impressed, but thought the American people were a bunch of suckers to fall for it. "But they do. I know that. I own a soft drink. It's called Umola. It's very big in the Midwest, and we're planning to expand it to a national brand after the war when we can get sugar. And I suppose we'll be doing the same thing." Vic told him he should use radio and said he should buy a big rating show right off, not try to build one. "Incidentally, you have a wonderful product in that Umola, and that's the first insurance ad men look for." Mr. Umola was very interested in radio, especially network shows. "We use local spots," he said, but spots always seem small-time to me." "You kind of have to apologize to your friends at the club when you use spots. But when a product comes on the air with a big half-hour radio show coast to coast, that's big-time stuff." Vic foresaw some future business for Kimberly and Mag, or maybe it would be Kimberly and Norman by then, so he was very nice to the man. He explained why he'd recommended that Mr. Yumola buy a big established star with a high-rating show rather than try to build one. New shows are a 50-to-1 gamble, and it costs $1 million a year to gamble, including talent costs. You're not playing with marbles when you get into network radio. I'll be glad when this war's over and there's sugar and plenty of help and trucks and everything's normal again, Mr. Yumola said with passion. Yumola presents the Bob Hope Show. Oh, man, wouldn't that be something? It would, Vic said, except that Bob Hope has a 10-year contract with his present sponsor. He'll have to struggle along with some other name. Mr. Yumola was very naive. An ideal sponsor for an agency to have, if you protected yourself against him. Infatuated with the glamour of show business, and why not, thought Vic. After all, a man spends his life carbonating water and collecting bills and needling salesmen, then all of a sudden, overnight in fact, he can become an impresario with his company's money. He can buy and sell talent and call his friends in once a week to hear his man make jokes over the radio. He can call his agency next day and say, I think the performance was good, except for that fluff at the end. But the script was lousy. Incidentally, Mrs. Yumola thought so too. He can pick up the jargon of radio and offer suggestions for improving the stooge character in the middle spot. He buys himself an excuse to take frequent trips to Hollywood. He can attend parties given in his honor by his star. He can go back home and casually remark, last week on the coast, the star gave a party for me. And Greer... Miss Garson told an anecdote I think you'll enjoy. Then, as he gradually grows hep to this colorful new world, which is selling his product like crazy, he can discover new stars. He can fling a new singer into the air because he likes her bed style, and to hell with her singing style.